Dr. Prasoon Deb, doctor in Hyderabad, India. Good morning to you.
Good morning, yeah.
You voted there in India?
Yes, I've already voted. Thank you, yeah.
One of 714 million eligible voters are going to be voting over the next few weeks?
Yep, that's right, yeah.
Wow, I mean, that's a huge, huge number. Why is it that the U.S. democracy gets so much more attention than, you know, this Indian democracy, which is by far the hugest in the world?
I guess India is not as important both politically and economically yet as the United States.
Well, let me ask you a question, Dr. Dillon. Let me ask you a question. Yeah. If a candidate in India got the same number of votes as Barack Obama did in the United States, I mean, he won an unbelievable victory in the United States. If he got 60 million votes in India, that would be the end of his political career, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He'd probably have to forfeit his deposit.
Doing democracy by the numbers, the big numbers in India. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's a good Biggest Democracy in the World morning, Thursday, April 16th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is off with her new baby. And coming up this hour, more details on that Indian election. We also have some advice. If you're getting laid off from your job, how do you say goodbye? And more details on the Demjanjuk case, 60 years. The search for Nazi war criminals goes on throughout the world. All this coming up, but first, these headlines. President Obama heads south today. First stop is Mexico. He'll talk about the drug war, immigration, and the economy. The White House is already offering new help to Mexico on smashing drug cartels. Mexico wants the U.S. to crack down on illegal gun sales. Many of the heavy weapons used by Mexican gangs trace back to the United States. The Treasury is also working to strangle the gangsters' money supply. We'll go to Mexico City for a conversation about America and Mexico right after the headlines. The president's trip is one stop on the way to the Western Hemisphere Leaders Summit meeting, the Summit of the Americas. It's taking place in Trinidad and Tobago. Housing and jobs will dominate the conversation in the economy today. New numbers show foreclosures spiking last quarter. Listing firm RealtyTrax says foreclosure notices jumped nearly 25%. And we're going to hear about new homes a little later. In about a half hour, we'll also hear about new claims for unemployment. Femi, okay, what else is going on? Piracy, right?
Oh, yeah. The pirate story not quite over yet. The freed crew of the Maersk Alabama is now back home in America. They touched down outside of Washington, D.C. early this morning, and they were met by their families. The captain is still back there in Kenya, and he's awaiting a chartered flight home to Vermont. Indians are at the polls today. You heard from Dr. Deb at the top of the program. Now, polling shows that neither the ruling or opposition party have a decisive edge. Now, all the voting can't happen in the same day because of India's massive population. We will get the results in May. And the U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in Israel talking about the peace process. He's meeting with top officials in various factions of the Israeli government.
S&P and Dow up yesterday. They'll probably be down this morning. Have you been laid off? Do you have an exit strategy?
I shut everything off, and I just thought the reason I'm sent it at the end of the day is because the email says pretty much how I feel right now, and when I'm ready, I'll have these conversations with people.
How do you say goodbye when you're laid off and leave the workplace? It's a difficult question, and Femi Oke has been out in the economy with some very interesting answers coming up just in a few minutes' time. But we want your story of saying goodbye to the workplace. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Important presidential trip today. President Obama is in Mexico today for a meeting with his Mexican counterpart, Felipe Calderon. The talks are certain to touch on border security, immigration, and a rising tide of drug-related violence that has plagued cities on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, something we've reported on a lot on this program. Obama is touching down in Mexico City and will be the first U.S. president in the chaotic capital since a visit by Bill Clinton 12 years ago. For a look at what's on the president's agenda, we're joined from Mexico City by Joan Griot, Mexico correspondent for Time magazine. Joan, good morning.
Good morning.
It's interesting to note that the meeting takes place in Mexico City because on the one hand, It's the center of culture in Mexico, but it's also a bit of a bubble. If you're looking at Mexico City from a place like Chiapas to the south or from the border communities to the north, Mexico City is a very, very remote location to the instability in both of those places. What is President Obama likely to see that's important about Mexico in Mexico City? And what is likely to be concealed from him in this fortress? And I think you're seeing signs of that on the streets today.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Mexico City generally, Mexico is a very big country. So from a city like Tijuana, Mexico City is the furthest place. So Tijuana is the furthest place from Mexico City in the whole country. So it is a long, you know, long way. And like you say, from the jungles in Chiapas where, you know, where drugs are coming, you know, over the border, it's a long way from there as well. But Mexico City has always been the historic and the cultural center of Mexico. It's a huge metropolis with 20 million people. It has, you know, really the best and worst of Mexico here. So, I mean, it's really the ideal place to visit. Symbolic representation of how Mexicans, you know, feel their country is. But like you say, I mean, what exactly is Obama really going to see? I mean, his trip, he's going to fly into Mexico City airport. He's going to go by helicopter from the airport to a military base. And from there, he's going to go to the presidential palace. And then he's going to be taken around in a bulletproof limousine, a special bulletproof limousine they have, which they call the Beast, to a dinner at a museum close to the presidential palace, go to the hotel and fly out the next day. So he's not really even planning to step foot on the streets of Mexico City.
Huh. That's interesting. I'm wondering if, and I gather there's like 4,500 security forces that we know of on the streets of Mexico City. Does this make the point that some Bush administration officials were saying in the waning months and weeks of the Bush administration that Mexico is on track to be a failed state? Some sentiments that were echoed by individuals even after the inauguration of Barack Obama. Does it make that point, or does it say to the people of Mexico, no, in fact, we're secure, we're far from a failed state?
Inside Mexico, I mean, people in Mexico don't see themselves as being in a failed state. And I don't think having 4,500 police guarding President Obama changes their own perceptions too much. I think this idea about a failed state actually, the phrase first came from a paper by the Pentagon. And they were not actually saying that Mexico is a failed state now. They were saying that they were speculating about what might be the main problems that the U.S. Military has to deal with in the next 25 years. And on that, they looked at Mexico and the potential of Mexico collapsing in the future. So that was a little bit, in some ways, the nuance didn't quite come across in press reports.
No, indeed. I mean, it hit Mexican media like a firestorm. Joan Grillo, is there some fence mending that Barack Obama needs to explicitly do here to signal that that's not what the Obama administration thinks?
That's correct. You know, the Mexican government was very offended, you know, this phrase, you know, Mexican President Felipe Calderon, was very aggressive in talking about this, various occasions, saying that we're not a failed state, this is outrageous. On the other side, you know, the security is there because they want to make sure that nothing happens to President Obama. And although there hasn't been many attacks on U.S. officials in the entire drug war, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, there have been some attacks. Recently, there were some grenade attacks on the U.S. embassy or U.S. consulate in Monterrey. And there's obviously been a lot of attacks on Mexican officials, very high-ranking Mexican officials, sometimes even in their own home. They killed the head of the federal police inside his own home.
Well, Johan, let's talk a little bit about the extent to which Felipe Calderon is politically in trouble because of all of this drug instability, or is actually got the upper hand in this fight against the cartels. Listen to what Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said during her visit to Mexico just a few days ago. Listen.
We say enough to the cartels. We take them on and we take them out.
Now, Joan Grillo, she makes it sound as though the U.S. government is taking on the cartels, but in fact, it's Felipe Calderon who's both taking the military hit and the potential political hit here. How's he doing?
He's having a very tough time. It's been a very, very tough presidency for him. He came into power in December 2006. And one of the first things he did was said, I'm going to send the army out and I'm going to get the cartels. I'm going to bring these organizations down. And I think that he had hoped within 6 months that the violence would have calmed down and he had a good situation in his hands. I don't think he wanted to be here today, right now, where he is now, with 8,000 killings, 800 police and soldiers killed in this time. So he's having a very tough time. The problem is the whole nature of this type of conflict. It's been compared, been called here, Calderon's Iraq. And that's what it is. In some ways, a conflict that he can't. It's very hard to win. It's very hard to declare terms of victory, and it's very hard to get out of. But the more he can arrest, drug traffickers and thugs with guns again and again. And these people just keep on coming back.
But, Johan, it's hard. You say it's hard to set the terms of victory. It seems that Calderon is struggling with that in a lot of his rhetoric. I mean, just recently he said, and underscored that Mexico is in control of all of its territory, which seems to set the bar pretty low for a terms of victory.
Yes, it does. And even that Mexico is in control of all this territory is something which is under dispute. I mean, if you look last year at a place like Ciudad Juárez, where about 100 police were assassinated in the city, and in total about 1,600 people were murdered in the city, it's quite hard to argue, is Mexican government really in control of that city under those circumstances? So even that, you say that's a low bar. And even that's something quite difficult. But also, their goals they're thinking about is really reducing the power of these criminal organizations. These are vast criminal empires that make an estimated $30 billion a year trafficking drugs to the United States. And that's pretty hard to bring those down.
Right. Well, Johan, let's conclude with a discussion of Obama, who just returned from Turkey, where, people on the streets of Istanbul were calling him our president. Is there any sense of, basking in the glory of Barack Obama's global popularity on this trip? Will the Mexican people be excited in some way, or is this another visit by an American president from El Norte?
It's a very interesting question. There is some optimism here about Barack Obama. There are some people here who identify with him, who hope he brings some of his optimism, some of his initiatives to Mexico. But in some ways, it's interesting the fact that there isn't more. The day that Barack Obama won the election, when they were celebrating on the streets of London and Berlin, Mexico, right next to the United States, there wasn't really much celebration. It was kind of muted. So, for whatever reasons, maybe some complicated reasons, but people are looking forward. They have got some hopes in Obama. But older people in Mexico tell me that they're not as excited as when John F. Kennedy came to Mexico.
Really? Well, that's the bar. Yeah, that's definitely the bar. Well, Johan Grillo, Mexico correspondent for Time magazine, watching as Barack Obama lands in Mexico City for a meeting with Felipe Calderon today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Certainly an indication that the economy is one of the issues, along with political stability and the fight against the drug cartels. Here's Felipe Calderon describing perhaps the terms of victory in the drug wars.
I have not lost at all any part, any single point of the Mexican territory.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you're hearing my voice, you know probably at least one thing about me, and that is that I have a job. Millions of Americans are getting laid off, though, and people all over the United States every week, and we get more jobless claims today, later on this morning, are saying goodbye to their workplace, to their coworkers. And how they do that maybe suggests the tone in which they will approach a real change in their lives. And so as we consider it a mission here on The Takeaway to get behind the numbers and to bring you voices, sentiments, the sort of hearts in the statistics of what's going on in the economy, we sent our own Femi Okeh off into the world to look at a slice of this.
Yes.
And we want to remind you before I let Femi go and tell you what she's learned, that we're actually looking for your stories of how you said goodbye in your workplace to your coworkers. What was your exit strategy? Was it a strategy or was it more of a tantrum? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake. thetakeaway.org. And this was the slice that you went off to take a look at, how people are saying goodbye. And I actually thought it was a great idea. What did you find?
It was fascinating, John. I was starting to look at people's email. They were telling me how they were saying goodbye. And something occurred to me immediately that I couldn't do this by myself. What I really needed was some expert help. She's sitting just across the way from me here. Cheryl Spanier is a career consultant management manager. And Cheryl, you actually help people transition from one job to another job, keep on track with their career. So is there a good way or a bad way to say goodbye, Cheryl?
The best way to say goodbye is simply with heartfelt thanks and gratitude and a very simple short statement.
I'm going to share with you some of the email that I came across. So let's start with Alison Walker. Now, Alison worked in the entertainment division of the ACLU. Now, she was laid off in January. And on the very last afternoon at work, she spent an hour and a half composing a goodbye email. But she waited until the very last minute before sending it.
I packed up everything in my office and was getting ready to leave. And I hit send. I didn't even think it could have possibly gone out yet, and my office line started to ring, my cell phone started to buzz.
So Alison has a contact file of 6,000 people.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
There's a network.
Now, she was very selective about who she sent the email to. Cheryl, who should you be sending email to on your final goodbye?
I think you need to think strategically. What's the point, and what's the message, and who do you need to know about this message now?
Right.
So take this job and shove it is not your suggestion.
That might not work so well, John. Yeah. But this is what Alison did. She did think strategically. She didn't send the email to all 6,000. I think they were probably all forwarded eventually because her email went viral. She sent it to 1,000 colleagues and associates, and her email was basically witty, sad, hopeful, and of course angry.
King Bernie Madoff and other evil, greedy assholes like him destroying our economy has caused the ACLU to scale back and eliminate 36 positions. I, Alison Walker, have been eliminated.
Okay, so no shortage of personality there. And Alison's content, she thanked her colleagues. She talked about being inspired by, actually, of all things, a yoga retreat. She wanted to be that calm, meditative person that she was in her yoga lessons in real life. So on her mailing list, there was a theatre director called Eric Krebs, and Eric actually loved her email.
I thought, oh, this is an email that almost any one of us could write in our lives. I'm changing it all. I'm dropping what I've done. I am also in a place where I frequently think about, okay, what do I want to do in the rest of life? So there was some of me contained in her gleeful and rueful email.
Cheryl, I actually went to Alison's former employers and asked them about her email, and they said we're not going to comment on an individual case. But what are the repercussions if you upset or perhaps embarrass your boss?
Well, there are several things. First of all, she's seeking sympathy here, and she should be looking for support. So the very people who may empathize with her reaction immediately may then be her sources of future opportunities, including her current employer. So if you complain about, if you criticize, or even say, I think I'm going to, you know, go and be on a yoga retreat, the consequence of that is that they will think differently about you than perhaps you want them to when you start that job search.
Are there certain things that you shouldn't call your former boss, for instance?
Yes. Don't say anything negative about your former boss, because there's going to be a future boss who's going to know about that. And do you think he wants you to work for him if you've spoken that way about your current employer?
And no kidnappings or holding them hostage or anything like that either, right? Okay.
You have to behave in the job search the way you want to be seen in the job.
So I found a famous, famous email from a Bloomberg employee. I'm going to call him Mr. Angry. I know who he is, and we have been in contact. He was very, very upset about his boss, and he let all of his colleagues know about it.
I thought you were a cool manager, till, of course, you ascended to the ranks of tomfuckery. Napoleon syndrome? Little man's disease, anyone? Why do you stomp so hard when you walk? You're like 67 pounds.
You're shaking your head, Cheryl.
This is beyond shocking. He may feel that way about this individual. To put it in writing, in a situation where anyone can then forward it and read it, really can backfire on him. And how does it make any difference in terms of his boss's future? Very little.
You have a book out called Leave Happy, Making the Elegant Executive Transition. One of our listeners actually sent us an email that I thought was beautifully elegant. His name is Philip Turner, and he used to be a book editor until January. And when I asked him to tell me what was the favorite part of the email that you sent to your colleagues, this is what he read to me.
I am viewing this as a kind of liberation in ramping up the search for my next act. I have some concrete ideas and early prospects about how I may again do what I call a purpose-driven imprint, even better this time around.
I know Phil Turner.
From your history of writing books, probably.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He was told on the same day you're leaving the office, and that was it. So often you get this news, and it's right at the last minute, Cheryl. So if there's only one thing that we're going to remember from what you've been telling us today, what should that be?
I think this was an inspirational comment and really brilliant, because what he said to his readers was, this is okay for me, and then he primed them with an idea about what he's looking for next, what he's going to do next. So he thought about their feelings as well as his own.
I'm going to leave you with one final email story. This one comes from a journalist called Marcy Alberher. She sometimes actually comes on to talk to us here on The Takeaway. She talks about jobs, job opportunities. So what happened to her a few months ago? It's kind of ironic.
I was a blogger and columnist for The New York Times until the fall, the late fall, when my blog and column were suddenly, without any notice, called to an end. First, I wrote about my losing the blog in a blog post, and then I wrote a farewell to my readers post. And then what happened was extraordinary. I got an outpouring of support in the comments of my blog, but the really wonderful thing that happened is I got a lot of job opportunities.
So that's Marcy Alberher talking about her job opportunities. You have an opportunity to pick up Cheryl Spanier's Tips for an Elegant Exit. That's online at thetakeaway.org. And you can also see Alison Walker, the movie about bleeping Bernie Madoff. John.
Thank you, Femi. Your stories as well at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this segment with some new economic numbers and the headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. The time is 8. Oh, I didn't mean to give the exact time. 32 minutes past the hour. So we just got some unemployment figures in for jobless claims. They were down 53,000 to 610,000. That was for last week's. And housing starts for March, 10.8%.
Down.
Down.
Yep, that's right.
So, President Obama heads to Mexico today to offer President Felipe Calderon support in the battle against drug and weapons smuggling. The U.S. is already sending manpower and money to help the fight against drug cartels there. And then after his meeting in Mexico, the president will head to the island nation of Trinidad and Tobago. That will be tomorrow for the Summit of the Americas, and it's a gathering of top Western Hemisphere leaders. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be at the summit as well, and she's also making stops along the way. Today she will be in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And that's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So the name may not be known to you, but John Demjanjuk is famously accused of being a Nazi death camp guard. And in a dramatic judicial turn of the wheels on Tuesday night in Ohio, Demjanjuk was granted a reprieve from an appeals court which is holding his deportation to Germany for a possible war crimes trial where he will be accused of being involved in the Holocaust. Well, what does this mean? His family plead yesterday for his innocence.
I hope everybody can hope and pray that an innocent man is being treated very, very wrongly. The things that we all saw inside of that house, you guys didn't see how much pain he was in, screaming and agonizing pain. So I can only hope that maybe everybody can open up a place in their heart and pray tonight that maybe things will take a turn for the better.
He's 89 years old, John Demjanjuk is. His extradition, according to his family, would kill him. But the war crimes trial in Germany is seen as central to getting to the bottom of who this man is and how important is he in getting to the question of justice for people involved in the Nazi death camps. And 60 years after, the search for Nazi war criminals still goes on. Joining us to talk about this is Jonathan Silvers, who's a documentary filmmaker, investigative journalist, and a former investigative producer at ABC News, and also David Marwell, the director of the Museum of Jewish Heritage. Both are here in the studio. David and Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So let's talk first of all about this case, Demjanjuk. This is the longest-running deportation case for any crime, let alone something related to the Holocaust and the Third Reich. How important is the legal issues that transpired this week?
Well, the case is extremely complicated. It is, in fact, 30 years old, and it involved, in the course of its history, an extradition to Israel in 1986 for a war crimes trial there, for which he was convicted, and then that conviction overturned. And then returned to the United States, had his citizenship returned to him, and then it was taken away again, and he was ordered deported in 2005, I believe. And now the Germans have decided that they have sufficient evidence to put him on trial for his war crimes, and he's awaiting deportation to Germany for those.
And
for
what
trial.
What is specifically the allegation?
The allegation is that he was a guard at the Sobibor concentration camp. He's not accused of being Ivan the Terrible. He's accused of being a guard in one of the most extreme concentration camps that the Nazis created.
But the Ivan the Terrible allegation floats around this case. Why?
He was initially thought to have been Ivan the Terrible at Treblinka, the man who ran the diesel engines which provided the exhaust gas, which was the agent of death at Treblinka. That allegation was the nature of his trial in Israel, and that was overturned because the court found that it was a mistaken identity, that he was not Ivan the Terrible, but he was indeed a camp guard at Sobibor.
Why are the Germans doing this now? This man is 89 years old, and this case has been going on for 15 years. And what do you make of the family suggesting that he's innocent, he's 89, and the whole trial is going to kill him?
Well, the Germans, first of all, must have very good evidence. The Soviet archive recently opened, or rather opened over 10 years ago, and the evidence that was provided obviously gives them enough credibility to mount a case against the man. The key component of this case is that he took part in acts of persecution against Jews in particular.
And he's a guard. And certainly the Nuremberg trials were about people at the very top of the Nazi hierarchy. Being a guard, does this make this trial significant in the sense that it really gets to the issue of the infrastructure of death in the Third Reich?
Well, of course, in Germany after Nuremberg, there were many camp guards that were put on trial. But I think your point is well taken, that it's very important that not only those who were involved at the higher levels be brought to justice, but also those who were the mechanics of death, as it were.
So you don't think this case is in any sense a distraction, that it's really central to the issue of turning the wheels of justice and getting to the bottom of, you know, what really went on 60 years ago?
Well, a principle of justice is that enemies of humanity must be punished if humanity is to survive. And I don't think the intervening decades, the 65 years that have passed since the end of the war, at all minimizes crimes.
So what is the appeal, and why was the deportation order granted a stay?
Well, the family suggests that deportation would constitute torture, and that's the legal issue now before the courts. I don't think they'll prevail. I think he will be deported to Germany, and I think the German system will then have to run its course.
Do you see this as a delaying tactic by his family, Demjanjuk's family?
The concept of defense for most of these cases is to delay to the point where the suspect or the accused dies in the United States.
What is the track record in Germany of prosecuting individuals at this level in the Holocaust infrastructure, the guard level, the you know, lever pullers on the death camps?
Yeah, I don't know that specific fact, but there were at least about 100,000 investigations in Germany in the post-war period. About 6,000 to 7,000 went to trial.
And how important is this search, which, as you say, goes on throughout the world, even 60 years later? Describe the level of this search and how people are focused on people like Demjanjuk, who many believe are still out.
Well, the search is in its final stages, let's be clear. Both the hunters and the hunted are aging, they're dying off, and the generation or the cohort of Nazi criminals is all but gone. But the fact remains that you must adhere to first principles, and first principles are that murder must be punished, crimes against humanity must be punished. And we see time and again that individuals around the world have forced either by shaming their governments or provoking their governments somehow to act against these Nazi suspects.
David Marwell, in the few seconds that we have, what's the next step here, do you think? You said you believe he will be deported, but what's the next step specifically?
Well, he'll be put on a plane, taken to Germany, and then put on trial by the Germans.
So this stay will probably run its course, and we will see a trial here.
I believe so.
But it is a race against time. John Demjanjuk is 89 years old. Our thanks to David Marwell, director of the Museum of Jewish Heritage, and Jonathan Silvers, documentary filmmaker and investigative journalist with a film in progress about the 60-year search for Nazi war criminals. Thanks to both of you. And just a final note, economic numbers just out within the last 10 minutes. New jobless claims fall for the second straight week to 610,000, and the futures market is reacting positively to that within the hour Wall Street will open. And housing construction plunges a worse-than-expected amount to its second lowest level on record, a decline of 10.8% for the month of March.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And yes, folks, you know, check your wire machines. There is a national bedbug summit taking place, and it is no joke. A summit on pest control, and bed bugs are the first pests hitting the beach in what's expected to be a possibly climate change motivated, population explosion motivated invasion of pests of all kinds that scientists are just now beginning to deal with. Greg Bauman is the vice president and senior scientist and technical director for the National Pest Management Association. He joins me from Raleigh, North Carolina. Mr. Bauman, a national bed bug summit. Is no joke, correct?
You got that right, John. It was certainly quite an event. It's the first time that entities involved with bed bugs, from university researchers to housing people to government officials to our industry, which was the professional pest management industry, it's the first time we all got together to talk about this emerging pest. In the last 10 years, we've seen an explosion of bed bugs.
Now, last time, in our last episode, the bed bugs emerged because of the concentration of humans in not terribly well-maintained cities around the world. What's the responsibility? What's going on now?
Well, you know, this is not something that's just occurring this year. There are times where you hear about pests, maybe mosquitoes. It's going to be a bad year for mosquitoes. This has been several years in the making. So this is a reemergence as opposed to just a hot spot of bed bug explosion, say. Because remember, these bugs live inside. They live with us. And so they're not going to be subject to the weather. So what's going on now? Well, people, there are many theories as to why this is happening. Some people do believe that there are products that were used for pest control in the past not available anymore. But probably most likely, I think you hit it on the head, the huge, dense human population certainly promotes the spread. But this is not something that's related to leaving out food or something that's considered a dirty hotel or a dirty apartment
like
that.
I hear what you're saying. We're the food, right?
We are the food. We are the only food.
We are the only food. Any other pests that are looking for a human population explosion chow down bonanza here?
Well, we're certainly hoping not. We have not seen a reemergence of a pest like this in recent memory. So this is something that's really quite unique.
So what is the science here, and what are the countermeasures that that humans are going to have to come up with to not be overrun by this or any other pest?
Well, you know, it's really remarkable because to have all of these diverse people get together for a two-day period, talk about the situation, and come up with a plan, we're very proud of that. And it was really boils down, this is just my observation because we don't have any final documents yet, but bottom line is, number one, make sure we have really good education for all people involved, you know, from people that work in the buildings for early warnings. We'd like to see more research, and hopefully there'll be some funding available for that type of research and consumer awareness.
What about a spray or a pill or a ray gun?
Well, you know, that sounds really great, but it's a long process. And you know, I want to be really clear. We do have tools out there to combat this pest.
But a lot of science to get from turning the tools into an actual strategy, and the population grows. Greg Bauman, we're going to leave it there, but thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Greg Bauman, Vice President, Senior Scientist, and Technical Director for the National Pest Management Association, talking about the Bed Bug Summit, probably just episode one of an emergence, a reemergence of pests around the world.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So another decline in the number of new jobless claims. That's the latest economic statistic. But what are the voices behind those people who are saying goodbye to the workplace?
Yes, this is Kevin from Brooklyn. I remember in my younger days, my first job, I was fired from a law firm, and I left with class. I cursed, I lost it, I alienated, I was senseless and saddened.
How do you say goodbye in this economic downturn? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And the biggest democracy in the world goes to the polls. That in a moment, right after headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. The time is 12 minutes past the hour. Our partners at the New York Times have a front page story about who's tapping American email and phone calls. Intelligence officials tell the Times that the National Security Agency went beyond legal limits. The Obama Justice Department says that problems have been found and fixed. UN experts charged with watching North Korea's nuclear program are now gone. The communist regime kicked inspectors out, forcing them to shut down monitoring devices. Pyongyang ordered the expulsion after the UN Security Council condemned its recent rocket launch. Russia says that its decade-long operation in the majority Muslim Chechnya region is now complete. Troops fought two wars there against separatist rebels. Russia drew international criticism for the strong tactics it used in the mostly Muslim area. The violence extended all the way to Moscow. Chechen rebels were blamed for a series of deadly bombings there, and now Russia says that it has subdued the violence and neutralized armed groups in the mainly Muslim region. Some 20,000 Russian troops are still there. And finally, 93 musicians received an enthusiastic reception last night at New York's Carnegie Hall. The orchestra was made up of musicians selected by YouTube users, so the YouTube Symphony had just 2 days of rehearsal. And some of the musicians included a surgeon who's also a violinist and a cellist who's also a professional poker player. They played a 3-hour concert last night.
The YouTube Orchestra?
Yes.
That's the YouTube
Orchestra. Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, but YouTube, I mean, they could have been selected anyway. It didn't have to be by YouTube.
But they were selected and then they went to Carnegie Hall. It's the extra little bit at the end that makes it special.
You don't have to practice. Just go on YouTube. That's the new lesson. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right, so we talked about it a moment ago. The largest democracy in the world is in India. And here's how it sounded in Hyderabad, where elections are beginning today. 714 million people go to the polls in India over the next several weeks. This time around, there's a change. For the first time in some places, there will be electronic voting. It's been going on for years in India, but it just gives you a sense of the challenge and the scale of voting in the largest democracy in the world. And here to talk about the politics, local and otherwise, in India, and also the process of counting and voting in India is Nazis Avros from the BBC, South Asian editor. He joins us from London. Nazis Avros, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you.
First of all, let's talk about the politics for a moment. You have said, and others have commented famously, that it's sometimes hard to see a broad national issue in India where the scale of politics, the scale of local politics, is sometimes counted in the millions and millions of votes for very, very simple municipal style issues.
Yes, true. But there is a very broad issue which is valid for every election, which is the quality of life, economy, whether people's lives are changing. You must remember, more than 70% of the Indian population, India has more than nearly 1.2 billion people, nearly 70% of them, so we are talking about more than 700 million people living in rural areas. Their quality of life is not very good. Nearly 60% of the population, they live just below or above the poverty line. So for them, earning their daily bread is very, very crucial. And these are the people who actually change everything. They come and their vote counts. And these are the people who vote in and vote out governments. So that remains the very big issue. Other than that, as you mentioned, there hasn't been any big issue, national issue, on which people would really go out and vote. There are various regional aspirations. For last 20 years, since the 1989 parliamentary election, we have not seen one big national party being able to form government on its own in Delhi. So they are dependent on small regional parties from various states. India has 26 states, and there are various regional parties. They may have only about between 20 to 40 members of parliament in a parliament of 543 members. And they become very crucial in the formation of government. So those regional aspirations, the development of different regions, different states, and those issues become their bargaining point and the bargaining chip when they deal with the major political party, national party, and go into a coalition.
Now, in the elections in neighboring Pakistan, we've seen that the leaders of Pakistan have really taken a political hit inside their country for focusing so much on the United States and issues outside of local politics. Is there a sense in which Indian politicians are looking at all to the global situation, particularly the new Obama administration, positioning themselves in some sort of future relationship?
Not that way. Foreign policy does not feature very high in these elections. One big thing, one very big global issue, of course, is very important, is the global economic downturn. When the advanced economies are in deep recession, including the US and Europe, now many of the Indian industries, they have big businesses in these with these advanced economies. India, unlike China, India is not so much dependent on export. India's economy is not dependent so much on export. Even the export they do, it's mostly knowledge-based, like IT industry. And they're doing relatively well in that. So India has not been hit like the way the advanced economies have. That massive growth India was registering for the last few years, at the rate of 9% per year. That has slowed down to about 7%. But at the same time, the inflation has gone down. We have not seen huge unemployment like the way we are seeing in the US or in Europe. So those things, of course, matter. So people are slightly worried about the global economy. But at the same time, when we think we are looking at it in a way, it is helping the world economy in various ways. For the last 2 weeks, Indian stock market is doing remarkably well along with the other stock markets. And the stock market has appreciated by 40%. The main stock market based in Mumbai, India's commercial capital, it has appreciated by 20%, by 40%. And nearly half of that is foreign investment. So in a way, India is linked with the globe. And they understand that, and they have understood that their time has come in the global arena. And that is why when the G20 summit happened in London a couple of weeks ago, the Indian Prime Minister, he took time out from campaigning. He came to London. And they were making that point that our time has come. We should have greater say in IMF and World Bank. Well, so they're establishing.
And emerging markets all over the world are having that same kind of resurgence. Before we go, final question. Religious parties have been successful in mobilizing the great rural population for populist messages, and that's transformed Indian politics in the past. Why has no party been able to mobilize those same rural residents on economic grounds?
Regional parties, there was a time that was the late 80s, early 90s. There was a period, there was this Hindu-Muslim divide, and Hindu religious parties, various Hindu religious groups, they could rally around the religious sentiments. But eventually, ultimately, if the quality of life doesn't change, the voters will reject those parties. And this is exactly what happened.
Right.
And also one must remember, India, inherently, it's a very pluralistic society. Pluralism is inherent in the Indian psyche. So it's very difficult to ride on religious sentiment for a long time. So finally, you have to look at the economy. You have to change you have to change the quality of life of the voters. And when you come back after 5 years and ask for their votes, and this is where that is the biggest challenge for all the political parties.
Well, as we might say in the United States, it's the economy stupid, but no Indian would be so impolite as to use the word stupid. Nazis Avroz, thanks so much for joining us, South Asian editor at the BBC World Service. It will take months to vote and then weeks to count those votes, but we will have a result, and the coalition building will be difficult in India, the largest democracy in the world. Nazis Avroz, thanks so much for joining us. Finally, lots of people laid off recently. If you were one of them, how did you say goodbye? We talked to Cheryl Spanier, a career consultant who has her own advice.
Don't say anything negative about your former boss, because there's going to be a future boss who's going to know about that. And do you think he wants you to work for him if you've spoken that way about your current employer?
Yeah, but Cheryl, I mean, come on. It's hard to resist. Daryl from Georgia said there wasn't any time to say goodbye.
A lot of people I know, myself included, get let go pretty much on the kind of notice that you may have a few hours or a day, but not really time to contact very many people other than who you immediately work for.
Stories of saying goodbye at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Twenty years ago, the world held its breath. As a political uprising began in China, the death of a Chinese leader, Hu Yaobang, started the student protest movement that began the Tiananmen Square confrontations. 2 decades later, the world is holding its breath for a very different reason. Chinese economic growth is the engine of the global economy. What is the latest number? China crisis. So 80s on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. No more calls. We have a winner. Yes, that was the band China Crisis from the 80s. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is off with her new baby. Coming up this hour, the president pays taxes. Lots of taxes. The guy doesn't have to work. We'll find out why. Also, The Color of Money, our series on different paths post-employment, depending on your race and ethnicity. Healthcare is the focus this morning. All this and more. First headlines. Job numbers, some good news. The number of Americans filing jobless claims dropped in the previous week. The week ending April 4th, analysts thought they would go up. But disappointing new housing numbers out the last hour. New housing construction plunged more than 10% last month at the second lowest level on records going back half a century. The drop was worse than economists expected. All this on the heels of another dismal housing report. Foreclosure notices in January through March jumped nearly 25% from the same quarter last year. Rick Sharga of listing firm Realty Track crunches the numbers and says it's too soon to tell whether new White House housing moves have helped.
The Obama administration announced its foreclosure mitigation program on March 6th, and we're talking about March numbers, so it's really not practical to assume they would have had any effect in the month of March.
Much of the spike comes from March when banks lifted moratoriums on foreclosures. Femi Elke, what's going on?
Good morning, John. Good morning, all. President Obama heads south today. First stop is Mexico, where he'll talk about the drug war, immigration and the economy. The White House is already offering new help to Mexico on smashing the drug cartels. Mexico wants the U.S. to crack down on illegal gun sales. Many of the heavy weapons used by Mexican gangs trace back to America. The president's trip there is on the way to the Summit of the Americas. It's a meeting of Western Hemisphere leaders kicking off in the island nation of Trinidad and Tobago. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will also attend the summit. The freed crew of the Maersk Alabama is now back home in the States. They touched down outside of Washington, D.C. early this morning, and they were met by their families. Their captain was not on the flight. He's still in Kenya, waiting for a chartered flight back to Vermont.
All right, U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in Israel today talking about the peace process. He's meeting with top officials in various factions of the Israeli government, a complicated affair there. Tomorrow he meets with West Bank Palestinian leaders and discussing their splits, the political challenges for George Mitchell later on tomorrow when we talk on the program about the Middle East initiatives of George Mitchell. The S&P grew 1.25%. It starts trading this morning at 8:52. The Dow gained 1.33%. It starts trading at 80.29. The futures have turned up in the wake of the housing and unemployment numbers that were announced in the last half hour or so. There have been a lot of layoffs yesterday, but if you were one of them, what was your exit strategy? How did you say goodbye to your employees? Was it in an email, a phone call? What tone did you use? Were you polite or were you a little angry? 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. And it's worth thinking about. 20 years ago, the crisis in China was very political and the events that led up to the Tiananmen Square confrontations. But these days, when people around the world hold their breath for what's going on in China, they're thinking about the economy. Today, China announced that its GDP grew at a rate of 6.1% in the first quarter of 2009. We would envy that growth, of course, but it's a big slowdown. China reported that its economy had been expanding at a 10.6% clip a year ago. And here to answer the question of what does declining Chinese growth mean for the rest of the world, and particularly for political stability or otherwise in China, is John Pomfret, former Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post, author of Five Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and The Story of the New China. He also has the blog called Pomfret's China. John, it's nice to talk to you again. First of all, this number, how significant is it?
It's definitely a significant drop, but it's about what experts expected. And it's a sign that China's basically muddling through. It's, you know, there were people in Washington that said, oh my gosh, the wheels are going to fall off China. This thing's going to end in a basket. But it hasn't happened. I don't think it's going to happen.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual measurement of the number. I mean, China isn't like the United States, where the sectors of the economy are I wouldn't say well monitored, but there's a little more empirical clarity to what's being measured here. What's the sort of gray area, the murkiness in this statistic?
Well, basically, when China's economy is red hot, the numbers always downplay the growth, and when it's slowing significantly, the numbers always upplay the growth. That's because Chinese officials basically will juke the numbers in order to protect their skins. Just the way it works in China.
There's a political filter, but there's also some difficulty in actually measuring what's going on because of the scale of the economy.
Indeed. I mean, you're dealing with, you know, a country that is trying to use modern statistics to cope with an economy that's still, in some parts of the China, it's a first world economy. In other parts of the China, it's a fifth world economy. So there are those logistical difficulties as well.
Now, Chinese officials in recent weeks and months have pointed to a decline in U.S. demand as being mostly responsible for the decline in growth in China. Does China have a way of spurring its own domestic demand the way the U.S. did during the Gilded Age, now well over a century ago, to energize its own manufacturing economy?
Definitely. I mean, you saw it reflected in the numbers that were announced today. I mean, you have retail sales going up in China 15%, whereas their exports have dropped 25% over this first quarter. And so they're definitely looking at domestic consumption to be the horse that's going to carry the economy into the future. And they've got to do that. I mean, you got a country of 1.3 billion people. So it's sort of a no-brainer to rely on your own people's purchasing power. They haven't really made that switch, but I think this crisis will energize them into pushing for more of that switch. I mean, their stimulus package, which is either the world's biggest or the world's second biggest stimulus package, is also devoted a large chunk of its money to increasing domestic demand.
You know, I looked at the calendar this morning. I know where I was 20 years ago today, and as we head into the late spring, early summer, thinking about what happened in Tiananmen Square, I know where you were back then. But it kind of takes your breath away that 20 years ago, in the week that Hu Yaobang died, who was perceived to be a democracy reformer, very close to the students who ended up confronting the government in Tiananmen Square, 20 years ago, people held their breath for political changes and political reasons in China. Two decades later, it's all about the economy. I mean, that really represents a very dramatic shift, something that you've observed through your entire career. What does that mean?
That is a great question, John. I was thinking about that today. I've been thinking about the whole Tiananmen Square issue, obviously, for the last couple of weeks as we near the June 4th anniversary, the 20th anniversary. One of the things is that in the West, we always have this idea that China somehow is poised on some type of a banana peel, about to either fall off the cliff politically or economically. In 89, the banana peel was a political banana peel that they're about to slip onto and then collapse. Now there's concerns, oh my goodness, it's going to be the economic banana peel. But the interesting thing about China over the last couple of decades is that, one, they've had this amazing growth. And the second thing is, whatever we predict that the wheels are about to fall off, they never do so far. And I think that's part of the narrative we have in the West, that this country is inherently unstable. It can't continue the way it's going. And the funny thing is, it keeps on muddling through. And perhaps the people who are arguing that the muddling through scenario is the right one actually have been right all along, and I think they have.
Well, the muddling through narrative is actually something that you devote a lot of time on your blog, Pomfret's China, and I recommend it. But describe a little bit about how, number one, over the last 20 years, we can say that China has been a winner. They won over the students. They certainly have won tactically and otherwise in the Tibet controversy. But despite their victory and the growth that you've just described, they're bad winners. They managed to botch it in a way. Describe, in the case of Tibet, what you're talking about here.
Well, first let's talk about the winning. They have been enormously successful in winning over China's elite, basically by saying, look, you can do anything you want in our society. You can have three mistresses. You can travel overseas. You can dabble in minimal corruption, or actually in some cases large-scale corruption, smoke pot, whatever, as long as you don't engage in political activity organized against the party state. And the elite, the Chinese elite, have basically bought into that idea.
So Bill Clinton could do really well.
Apartment. If you make a lot of money, you can own 5 apartments. We don't care. You can exploit people. That's not a big problem, as long as you don't organize against the state. So that the elite has bought into that completely. And because the elite has been so important in sparking Chinese revolutions, I don't really perceive or posit a revolution in China's future. On the Tibetan question, they occupy Tibet with 250,000 troops. The Dalai Lama, obviously, internationally has a huge profile, but they've been successful basically in convincing every country around the world that Tibet is an inalienable part of China. That said, they will go out of their way to limit the Dalai Lama's travel opportunities. For example, recently, because of their pressure, South Africa disinvited the Dalai Lama to a conference of Nobel Prize Peace Laureates. They have a sort of a small-minded perspective on, look, we're winning, so what we need to do is to crush this guy. In the end, that hurts China's image, and so on the one hand, in China, you have them enormously succeeding in terms of lifting 200, 300 million people out of poverty over the course of the last 2 decades. At the same time, they don't get the international bounce, the public relations bounce that they could from these type of successes because they tend to be so nasty and small-minded on issues such as the Dalai Lama, whether right. he can or cannot travel. Well, guy at root is basically a monk. And to limit his travel abilities just seems to be a sort of a small-minded issue that they obsess about when they hurt themselves by not allowing us to focus on the bigger picture, which has been this enormous economic success.
Well, John Pomfret, let's talk a little bit broader then. I mean, I think in the case of the Dalai Lama, it may be politically needless to focus on crushing someone who, as you say, they've already won politically. But in the case of the relationship with the United States, it seems as though the Obama administration is intimidated by the Chinese and is backing off on a number of points. The notion of going soft on China is something that's openly discussed in Washington. Timothy Geithner, who is really tough on kind of accusations of currency manipulation, has now backed off of that. What's going on here?
I think the Obama administration, I'm not inside it, so I'm just guessing, is looking at China as a potential partner. They desperately want China to be a partner in righting the world's economic ship of state. As such, they're willing to sideline, soft pedal, de-emphasize, or basically ignore significant problems that exist in the United States-China relationship. So, for example, when Hillary Clinton went to China on her first visit, it was to Asia. It was a very good, very, very big sign. She basically, before she went to China, said, look, I don't really want to talk to the Chinese about Tibet, Taiwan, or human rights because I know what they're going to say. There was a lot of blowback about that. She didn't talk about that anymore. But the reality is they're not talking about human rights like they used to.
And, of course, the big headline today is 6.1% growth in the first quarter of 2009. Lots to talk about. We're going to leave it there. John Pomfret, thanks so much for joining us. Pomfret is the former Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post and author of 5 Chinese Lessons, 5 Classmates, and The Story of the New China. His blog is called Pomfret's China. So if you got laid off, how did you say goodbye to your colleagues? What's the exit strategy here?
I shut everything off. And I just thought the reason I'm sent it at the end of the day is because the email says pretty much how I feel right now, and when I'm ready, I'll have these conversations with people.
After the pink slip, when did you get ready? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Saying goodbye in an economic downturn.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've been talking this morning about President Barack Obama's pending meeting with Felipe Calderon of Mexico. And it reminds us, you know, does this voice here that I'm about to play for you ring a bell?
In December, we started active operations. And during that month, we're able to triple the seizures of cocaine and other drugs being brought across the border as compared with a year earlier.
Well, of course you don't recognize that voice. That is the voice of Alan Burson. He's been appointed by President Obama, he's a former U.S. attorney, to a newly created position of border czar. That's right. If you live on the border of the U.S. and Mexico, he's your new czar. Alan Burson is going to be responsible for cracking down or maintaining the stability of the border, at least on the U.S. side of the border, where the Mexican government is cracking down on drug cartels, which has led to all kinds of instability and lawlessness that we've reported on this program in cities like Juarez and Tijuana. Joining us to talk about Alan Burson, the concept of a czar, and the question of what is needed to maintain stability in these border communities is Amita Sharma, who's an investigative reporter for KPBS in San Diego, California. Amita, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And Diana Washington Valdez covers the border for the El Paso Times. She's author of the forthcoming book, Mexican Roulette, Last Cartel Standing. Welcome back to the show, Diana.
Oh, thank you, and good morning to you all.
So, Amita, even though I didn't recognize the voice of Alan Burson, people in California who followed the drug wars back in the mid-90s will recognize Alan Burson very well. What's he like, and what does the appointment of this personality mean for Barack Obama's policy down in the border region?
Well, Alan Burson is a very smart man. He's a former Rhodes Scholar who, over the years, has accumulated quite a diverse resume. He is considered to be the perfect person for this job. He was on the border before in a related capacity as a U.S. attorney in San Diego during the 1990s, as you mentioned. He's described by friends as a student of Mexico. He studied the country. He speaks Spanish. He's called hardworking and dedicated. But above all, the people who know him say he gets the issues. If anyone has the expertise and the understanding of the formidable challenges of dealing with the drug cartels and illegal immigration, they say it's Alan Burson.
You know, that sounds nice, but Diana Washington Valdez, you know, if you're a governor of a border state, Arizona or California or Texas, which you cover in the El Paso area, I mean, what do you make of a czar in your own state?
Well, that's a question that many people have is, you know, the United States already has a drug czar, and we have had one for many years. And despite having a drug czar with a direct pipeline to the White House, to the president, the drug trade continues as never before.
And so, you know, I guess the question is one of policy. Will he be responsible for actually sealing the border or administering immigration policy? I mean, certainly the narrative of what's going on in the border has changed dramatically over the last year. Or is he simply going to take the fall for criminality if it does manage to spill over? Diana?
Well, the spillover is very interesting. I mean, we already have the cartels operating within the United States and, as you know, in Canada as well. And so stopping the activity at the border does not necessarily mean an end to the drug trafficking and the drug violence that we've been preventing since 15 years ago. So it's still interesting to see what's going to happen with a new czar and what is exactly are going to be his responsibilities, what is his authority, who's going to answer to him, what is he going to be able to actually do to make a difference.
Amita Sharma, go ahead, Amita.
Well, I think, you know, part of that, you know, who's going to answer to him and who is he going to answer to? You know, he was appointed by Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, but he also has a couple of other, well, actually quite a few other presidential appointees who have rank above him. So I think a big question is where does he fit in to the flow chart? You know, he'll have four appointed U.S. attorneys, presidential appointed U.S. attorneys in this region. You've got the head of ICE, who is a presidential appointee. You've got the head of Customs and Border Protection, who is a presidential appointee. So he can go to them with his ideas, but they also have the power to say, you know what, who are you? And so it is going to be his job to convince his superiors to give him the support, the resources he thinks he needs to get the job done. But it will also be the job of his superiors to go to Congress and say, look, we need your support. We need the money.
What do you think the resource question is here? Are we talking billions of dollars, lots and lots of troops, and some sort of surveillance program and an active?
Yeah, I think we're talking surveillance technology. We're talking more. You know, I think President Obama has already said he doesn't believe in putting troops there now. He doesn't think it's necessary. But they are going to need more troops on. I mean, more boots on the ground, so to speak, in terms of border patrol.
Diana, does that make people in places like Juarez feel, or El Paso for that matter, feel more comfortable, or does it make the communities look more like an armed camp?
Well, so far the news has been welcomed by our neighbors across the border, and we have interviewed several of them, business leaders and so forth, and they welcome the opportunity to have someone who may help reduce the drug violence. But one of the things that I'd like to see happen is for this new official to perhaps put a spotlight and try to find and dig out the corruption that exists on our side of the border that has been facilitating the drug trade. You know, we've been focusing on Mexico a lot and the corruption there, but everyone agrees here that we have corruption on this side that also makes this possible. So where is it?
It's a tall order for Alan Burson to sort that out as he starts his job as border czar. Thanks so much for the perspective from Diana. Washington Valdez covers the border for the El Paso Times and is author of the upcoming book Mexican Roulette, Last Cartel Standing. And when her mother reads that book, she'll probably say it's Valdez rather than Valdez. And Amitha Sharma is an investigative reporter for KPBS in San Diego. We thanks to both of them. And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
At 28 minutes past the hour, kicking off another round of diplomatic talks, President Obama heads to Mexico soon. It's a visit to show solidarity in the battle against drug cartels and gun smugglers. He will meet with President Felipe Calderon to talk about border control, drug trafficking and immigration. Tomorrow, the president joins Secretary of State Clinton in the island nation of Trinidad and Tobago. That's where the Summit of the Americas is taking place. It's a meeting for the top leaders in the Western Hemisphere. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has announced a surprising policy shift. He says that Russia is ending its decade-long security operation in the southern region of Chechnya. Russian forces have fought two wars against separatist rebels in that area, and it's not clear how many Russian forces will actually remain there. And finally, Egypt's top archaeologist is looking for the tombs of Queen Cleopatra and her lover, General Mark Antony. A site with 20 tombs has been found just west of Alexandria in Egypt, and Egyptian archaeologists are excited that they may have actually found the very tombs. So that's a look at your news for now.
Wow, that's exciting. Thanks, fam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. New claims for unemployment come out later this morning, which means more of you out there in the country will be saying goodbye to workplaces and jobs. 8778 My Take with your story, how you did it. We talked about that earlier this morning. We're going to talk about it later. My Take at thetakeaway.org, the story of how you say goodbye to the workplace. But think about Barack Obama. He's not unemployed. No. He's got the hardest job in the world at one of the worst moments in world history, certainly in the last couple of decades. And we learned yesterday that he doesn't need to work. No, the president and vice president released their 2008 tax returns last night. And you know, Barack Obama's doing just fine. Here's Robert Gibbs.
The president sold a lot of books last year, no doubt, and paid a hefty amount in federal income tax.
I'm glad someone is joining us for a look through the president and vice president's W-2. And we should say, while Barack Obama is doing well, he's no Michael Bloomberg billionaire. But our man on Capitol Hill has the details. Todd Zwillick. Wow. Our president doesn't even need to work.
Sold a lot of books and paid a lot of taxes. True. and true. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Todd.
Get right to it. $2.656 million in joint income, the Obamas, in tax year 2008. Now, of course, this is when he was still a senator and running for president. This is before he became president. We're talking about 2008 figures. About $2.7 million in income, the vast majority of that from book sales, The Audacity of Hope, on which, according to their tax return, according to the White House, paid $855,000 roughly in federal taxes.
So his pre-presidential memoir, you know, $2 million. Can you imagine what the post-presidential memoir would be? We can't even speculate on that.
If he's a smart businessman, and we assume that he is, he'll get an even better deal.
He's doing fine.
Doing fine. Donation to charities. These things are standard on tax returns, and $77,000 in Illinois state taxes. Now, the more interesting thing to me about this is the Bidens. On last year's tax return, when Joe Biden was still a senator or running for vice president, joint income, Joe Biden and his wife, Jill, $269,000.
Now, you know, Biden has a rep, though, of being like Mr. Regular Guy. He rides the Amtrak back to his home, you know, from Washington. And so in some sense, it's not a surprise, but it's nothing like the Barack Obama number.
Well, it's nothing like the Obamas. And when you consider that senatorial salary, which is how much, John? You want to take a stab at it?
You know, it's six figures. That's all I know.
$169,300. That's what every senator makes. A majority leader might make a little bit more as a premium for being leader. But if you look on the 2007 disclosures that rank all the senators in terms of net worth, not their tax returns, but their net worth, Joe Biden, last.
Last? Who's first?
Who's first? John Kerry?
Really? Well,
Kerry, they report ranges. Now, we don't know exactly what these people are worth because they're not required to report their exact net worth. They report a range. But from best we can tell from the ranges in the disclosure, Senator John Kerry, Massachusetts, worth up to $388 million in 2007. A lot of that is catch-up money. His wife is Teresa Hines Kerry.
Right, of course. Catch-up
formerly
money.
Married Senator John Hines, deceased from Pennsylvania,
right.
The Hines family. The list of richest senators, by the way, we'll go down it real quickly. There's some names that you've heard and that you wouldn't be surprised that they're wealthy. Rockefeller.
Sure.
Kennedy.
Okay.
Hillary Clinton ranked number 11th between 10 and 51 million. The second wealthiest senator, John, is probably the wealthiest senator that maybe a lot of people have never heard of, Herb Kohl from Wisconsin. Senator Herb Kohl, worth up to $251 million. And if you're having a hard time knowing who Herb Kohl is, you heard of Kohl's department store?
Oh, there you go.
Herb Kohl.
Herb
Milwaukee
Cole.
Bucks. He owns
All right.
it.
Yep. Now, let's talk about the recession and, you know, members of Congress. I mean, is it affecting them? You know, a lot of congressmen, particularly GOP congressmen, but it's certainly not confined to the Republicans, run on the issue of being successful business people in their home districts. How does that work?
Right. Well, in some ways, members of Congress are just like the rest of us. Their fortunes rise and fall with the economy. And in some ways, of course, they're not. Look, they all have job security, you know, judging from the fact that incumbents are usually protected. Incumbents usually win, but they all have jobs. Those jobs aren't going away as long as they stay in office, and they all make $169,000. So it's a pretty good deal. That's in their salary. Now, in terms of net worth, when the financial disclosures come out, they file them in May, and they'll come out in June, and there's going to be something interesting this year because if you look on the list, I went on the website of our friends at the Center for Responsive Politics.
Right.
They're good government watchdogs here in Washington. If you go on the website, there's a great list on there. The top 50 companies that members of Congress are invested in. Okay? GE
this
is number
one. This is their portfolios.
This is their portfolio. GE is number one,
really?
The most popular company for members of Congress to invest in. Now,
they've
GE's
lost
down
a lot
about
of money.
66%.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Year. Okay, but then let's go down the list. Number five on the list of the most popular company to invest in is Bank of America, with 59 members of Congress invested. And I'll go down the list quickly.
Well, that's important for two reasons. That's number one, it's also gone down significantly. But number two, because it's so involved in the bank bailout, that's what something Congress deals with. So there's a conflict of interest there.
There's a potential conflict of interest, which is why we have disclosure. Disclosure is good, but it doesn't necessarily dissolve conflict of interest. Everybody has to be aware of that. But you go down this list of the top 50, Wachovia, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual, Citigroup.
Wow.
It has 49 members of Congress invested in it. It was trading at $27 a year ago, John. This morning it's going to open at about
four.
So salary stable, but net worth takes a dive and also embroils these folks in policies that they're actually voting on.
Potentially. And there's another little twist on this, too. Frank Lautenberg, senator from New Jersey, were one of the wealthiest senators. By the way, let me add, average wealth of a senator is $17 million. That's on average. So they're not hurting. Joe Biden's way, way below that. He's except for his house, he's worth basically zero, according to his disclosure. But Lautenberg's family foundation had about $15 million in with Madoff. And ostensibly has lost it all. We don't know how much Lautenberg has lost personally with Madoff. We may not know until around June 12th when those financial disclosures are filed and then reported to the public. We'll find out which companies Lautenberg was invested in and how much he lost personally with Robert Madoff.
Bernie Madoff. With the recession well represented at all, along with the financial sector all well represented in the portfolios and net worth of our congressmen and senators. Todd Zwillick, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Now headlines with Femi Oke.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, UN nuclear inspectors left North Korea today. The government ordered them out, angry that the UN Security Council condemned it for a recent rocket launch. State Department spokesman Robert Woods says this action will only lead to greater isolation.
It's a step backward. We're obviously concerned about this. In taking these decisions, the North is going to have to deal with the consequences.
Before they left, the UN inspectors removed seals and cameras from North Korean nuclear facilities. And a suicide bomber dressed in an army uniform detonated an explosive belt today as Iraqi soldiers lined up for lunch. The midday attack killed at least 16 Iraqi troops and wounded 50. That's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Wall Street open and up. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now from Bush House in London, our partners, the BBC, Alexei Solovenko is a regional analyst for our partners, the BBC, to talk about a statement that seems to be rather Soviet-style. Russia this morning said it ended its decade-long anti-terrorist operations, their words, in the southern region of Chechnya, where its forces have fought two wars against separatist rebels since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Last month, President Medvedev said Chechnya was stable enough to ease restrictions, but it isn't clear how many Russian forces will actually remain. Alexei, is this an example of the Russians basically calling off a war unilaterally, but the Chechens may have other ideas?
I think it's not the unilateral calling off the war. I think it's trying to reposition Russia itself vis-a-vis its strongman in the Caucasus in Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov. What happened, actually, this warlord, president, whatever is your preferred description, is basically running the place on behalf of the Russians with a very weird mixture of personal edicts, of combination of Sharia law with some remains of the Soviet secular legislation. And basically, he is oppressing, repressing, destroying, eliminating the opposition, the opponents, and controlling it to the best of his abilities, which are quite formidable at the moment. So in a sense, the Russians have funded him. They gave him a free hand, and he is sorting things out. So the violence is the violence that existed before the actual sort of warfare that existed between the Russian federal troops is no longer taking place in Chechnya. However, the whole area is still very unstable, and the fact that something is sorted out in Chechnya doesn't mean that violence doesn't exist elsewhere, just across the border in Dagestan and Ingushetia.
Right, well, let's talk about this scenario. Let's spin it out a little bit. I'm going to date myself, but this seems suspiciously like the Babrak Kamal scenario, where an Islamist sort of Soviet-style leader was installed in Afghanistan, and that sort of unraveled militarily, and the result we all know about it. Is this a puppet in Chechnya, and is it stable?
Well, a puppet, I think he is more than a puppet. If you read some of the Russian blogs and Russian commentators today, they say that certainly Ramzan Kadyrov has its own sides very, very high. And the way he tried to either remove or to pacify his opponents, people who stood against him, or people from other clans in that very very much clan-based society, was very, very effective. Also, there was an influx of money, a lot of money from Russia, geared towards reconstruction of the area. So in terms of the actual hold of power, I think it's much more stable than in the case of Babrak Karmal in Afghanistan. In terms of whether this is stable long-term, Chechnya has a history of instability that runs, you know, from the early 18th century and 19th century. Leo Tolstoy described the wars there, and a lot of similarities are really quite striking.
Just a couple of seconds. Is there a potential for infection of instability? You mentioned Dagestan. The region isn't known for stability right now. Are there any sort of cross-border issues?
Yes, there are very strong cross-border issues. There's a lot of violence in Ingushetia, in particular in Dagestan. It's not going away, and it's not clear how it can be sorted with purely military operation. The experience of Chechnya proves that military solutions are not working there.
Alexei Solohubenko, regional analyst with our partners, the BBC, talking about the Russian declaration that anti-terrorist operations in Chechnya are over. Thank you, Alexei. He spoke with us from London.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, The Color of Money, Healthcare, Post-Job. Our series continues right after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Coming to you at just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm watching the president actually speaking on the air right now. He is talking about how the United States must upgrade their high-speed rail system, lower energy dependency, and clear traffic congestion. He is going to have a busy day. He's on the way to Mexico to meet with the Mexican president there. Economics is going to be one of the hot topics, talking about Mexican drug gangs. Thousands have died in gang fighting, and some violence has spilled across the U.S. border. We have had a couple of economic numbers out this morning. Some good news in there. The number of Americans filing jobless claims dropped in the previous week. But some disappointing new housing numbers also out. New housing construction plunged more than 10% last month, and it's at its lowest level on records going back half a century. John.
So, thank you, Femi. Our theme taken from the Notorious B.I.G. album Life After Death, Mo Money, Mo Problems. Well, no money, big problems. And that's the theme of our Color of Money series we've been doing all week long. Today, our shift is to healthcare, the issue of healthcare. If you're unemployed or affected by this economic downturn, there are multiple paths that you can take. One path leads to a semblance of healthcare security, but other paths lead to healthcare insecurity and possibly a declining set of fortunes for both health and your economic woes for families. And here to discuss the economic, racial, and ethnic disparities in healthcare for people caught in the economic downturn are Kara James, senior policy analyst for the Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare Group at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She joins us from Washington. Kara, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And right here in the studio is Dr. Robert Schiller, Senior Vice President for Medical Services and Training for the Institute for Family Health, which is affiliated with Beth Israel Hospital right here in New York. Dr. Schiller, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
You know, tell me right off the bat, doctor, you know, an issue with a patient of yours, a client of yours, someone who comes through your institution who reflects, or maybe a pair of them, who reflects these different paths, depending on your race, ethnicity, class, regarding the likelihood of you retaining health care post-job?
Well, I have two recent incidents. One is a patient who is an architect in a fairly well-to-do firm who was traveling all over the world doing work and was summarily dismissed about 2 weeks ago. And really, without warning, he has no health insurance. He's married, has a teenage daughter, and he really is at a loss. He has diabetes, so he requires medication. He requires laboratory services, and it's really it's a tragedy for, you know, and this is a gentleman in his late 50s, sort of at the peak of his career, having to face this kind of problem. The second person is a younger woman who is an advocate in a housing organization who also was laid off. She has a disease called sarcoidosis that affects her breathing. She has to take medication, have x-rays and see specialists, and she's also at a loss. You know, fortunately, our organization is a federally qualified health center, and we have some resources for people to try to transition them through this difficult period of time. But the fact of the matter is the health disparities that currently exist in our healthcare system are exacerbated by this unfortunate economic downturn.
Well, I can hear the anger and the frustration in your voice, and you're on your way to deal with those clients, you know, once you leave this studio. Kara James, you know, Dr. Schiller has described two individuals with chronic healthcare problems, diabetes, and the other condition that you mentioned, Doctor. I mean, they're in some sense the first and really heaviest wave of demands on the healthcare system that come out of this economic downturn. What's the racial and ethnic picture for how these different groups are treated?
So there are disparities, unfortunately, in this country from cradle to grave. And, you know, starting at just infant mortality, we see high rates of disparities. As it comes to kind of the economic situation of what's happening, the diabetic patients that Dr. Schiller described, we are seeing across the board that they are cutting back on regular doctor's appointments, and we're finding that for our diabetic patients specifically, they are ending up, unfortunately, in the ER with unmanaged diabetes. As well as in other cases, the most vulnerable populations that are treated by Dr. Schiller and others in the community health services, the safety net is being severely strained. And for people of color who are reliant in large part upon these because they have lower incomes to begin with and qualify for these, and the racial gap between wealth that you've discussed earlier in this series this week requires that they are less able to deal with the economic crisis when they do lose their job because they just don't have the resources to fall back to purchase COBRA or some of the other insurance policies that they could get once they lose their job.
Well, Kara, you've mentioned the magic word. Most people who have jobs and have had jobs with some sort of health care coverage are in the business of being snake charmers. They know this word COBRA that you just mentioned. but is COBRA an equal opportunity health care safety net if you're an African American, if you're someone who works in a non-union shop or maybe a place that doesn't have a lot of benefits?
Unfortunately not. There are many people who don't qualify for COBRA, and even among those who do, it is really cost prohibitive for a lot of people because once you do lose your job, you just don't have an income coming in. So paying the higher premiums that COBRA has compared to your private insurance that you had through your employer just is not something that people are able to do. So unfortunately, they are not really able to take advantage of this opportunity.
You know, how does that work in your world, Dr. Schiller?
It's very difficult. This woman I was telling you about who has this lung disease was offered COBRA. She actually doesn't even know what this amount is at this point while she's being laid off. She has, as Karen mentioned, there's no additional source of income for her to be able to pay for these services. And so, you know, what's happened to our work is that now we have to work with people to try to figure out how they're going to get their health care needs met in a very creative and innovative way.
But what do you say to people? I mean, there are people that you have to say, in fact, I'm sorry, there's nothing for you.
Well, we tend to be much more optimistic and idealistic. In our organization, we try to identify community resources. We try to work with people in terms of identifying specialists who will see them basically for free.
But, Doctor, I don't want to push you on this inappropriately, but, I mean, diabetics are people who need regular, compliant care in terms of monitoring and in terms of taking of medication. And we're already hearing from Kara of people cutting back, basically avoiding doctor's appointments. How do you make the case that this is a priority when there are other family issues?
It's really very difficult, and we are seeing that. I mean, patients are constantly telling us, look, I don't have, you know, I'm having to cut back on my medication. If they need to see a specialist, they can't see them. And, you know, part of our work is to come to radio stations like this and get the word out there that this healthcare system really needs some attention and try to deal with these people.
Well, Kara, there's lots more to talk about here. I want you to leave us with some sense of what's the policy implication to address this racial and ethnic and class, really, disparity in healthcare for people caught in the economic downturn, if there is a policy implication that you can describe quickly.
I think there are many policy implications, and one, as we've described, is the safety net, which is much more a source of care for many more people of color. So making sure that we provide help to the safety net so that they can treat the patients that are coming through there of all colors, to be quite honest, because as people are losing their jobs, it's affecting everyone. I think another thing is helping that we focus, as we're going through these health reform conversations, focus on disparities, because they are not simply things that are going to be affected by an improved, I should say, by quality of care overall, but there are things that are particular, as well as the other social programs that we're talking about, because healthcare does not happen within a bubble.
Right.
It's affected by income and education, and so making sure that, you know, if you think about school programs, school lunch programs, that these programs stay in place so that kids have healthy nutrition.
And it's important to note, I mean, you can't wait for the economy to turn around to deal with health. That's urgent and right on the table. Kara James, Senior Policy Analyst for the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us from Washington. And Dr. Robert Schiller, Senior Vice President for Medical Services at the Institute for Family Health, affiliated with Beth Israel Hospital right here in New York. He's on his way to deal with those clients he was talking about. That's our Color of Money series this morning, more tomorrow. But a lot of people have been laid off recently, and if you were one of them, we want to know, what's your exit strategy? How would you say goodbye? I love this responder on our website. What's weird is to suddenly get a burst of emails from people you've never met who are on their last day. Someone types, "It's been a great ride, I love you all," and sends it globally. I'm thinking, who the hell is this? That's someone's response at our website, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
They desperately want China to be a partner in righting the world's economic ship of state. As such, they're willing to sideline, soft pedal, de-emphasize, or basically ignore significant problems that exist in the United States-China relationship.
That's John Pomfret talking about the Obama administration's approach to China. Its GDP growth is 6.1%, announced today. We would envy it, but it's an issue in China. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.